You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicars Media Motel.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, the general election reviewed, but what happens next? The DPP versus journalism. Periscope wins the boxing, and we all slow down.
Hello, everybody, and good morning, and welcome to the Parish Council post-election special. It comes from the Media Motel. I'm Magnus Shaw, and meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus.
Hello, sir. Sure. Hello.
5 years to go to the next election.
Yeah, well, congratulations to the victor, the spoils. I shake your virtual hand, sir.
Well, personally, I'll be happy to exist in an election-free zone for quite some time. I have to say, I found this campaign to be way too long, rather tedious and purposeless. And I suggest I'm not alone in that the opinion polls, in terms of percentages, hardly moved a point from start to finish. But in our system, national percentage points become irrelevant on the morning after the night before, and because it's all about the number of seats won. And as we record this at 9:30 a.m. Friday morning, it seems clear that Mr. Cameron's Conservatives will have an overall majority. As Ben Shepherd says to people on the tipping point, I think I know what you're going to say, but are you in the throes of despair or leaping around your living room in ecstatic fervour?
I just feel sort of dazed and confused, really. It wasn't what anybody expected, and it wasn't what I expected either. I didn't expect an overall majority from any party, but I was hoping for some kind of progressive alliance, I think, which I'm not going to get now, and neither is anybody else. But as you say, the percentage of the votes counts for naught. As it happens, I think even if we had some sort of system which recognised the percentage of the popular vote, it wouldn't have helped Mr. Miliband and his friends anyway, I don't think. Obviously, they would have more representation than they're going to have now, but it wouldn't have pushed them into first place. So whichever way you cut it, it was a resounding victory for Mr. Cameron, but even more so, and on a completely different scale, for Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary situation in that, other than the Scottish National Party in Scotland, no party can really feel a sense of jubilation. Yes, the Conservatives appear to have won, but it does mean we're more fractured as a so-called United Kingdom than ever before. One of the big stories that emerged just after 7 o'clock this morning was that after speculation through the night, that Ed Balls, the Labour shadow chancellor, lost his seat. I wondered about this now because, you know, a lot of senior Labour figures held on, and some increased their vote. I wonder whether the public, as opposed to Labour activists who think, oh, good old Ed Balls, but his behaviour in public and in particular at Prime Minister's questions that's everything that people hate about politics, that sort of gesturing and mugging and barracking and heckling. And Labour people think, oh, you know, he's showing those Tories what for. But the voting public are turned off by that sort of behaviour.
Yeah, there are plenty of Tories guilty of that as well. But I agree with you. It does people no favours. And one day, one hopes that politicians will wake up to the things which people find so objectionable. They will trot out glad words about how they understand people's concerns and that it's not good, is it? And then they will go ahead and be televised doing exactly that. I don't defend anybody who sits in Parliament and shouts abuse across the benches because it's just unseemly and unbecoming. But yes, here we are, the morning after the night before, and it does seem that turkeys really do vote for Christmas after all.
Well, you see, yes, I understand why you say that, and that's, you know, a lot of my Twitter timeline is filled with people saying similar things about, you know, we voted for our lords and masters to be driving round in gold-plated Ferraris and so on. Somebody actually said that.
Well, my concerns are more prosaic, really. I mean, I know an organisation on whose board I sit will probably cease to exist in the next 12 months now, and that means a good friend of mine will be out of a job, and more importantly, the service that the organisation provides will no longer be there for people who need it, and that makes me very sad, very sad.
Of course, I can understand how you feel that way. Yet for all of the people I've noticed on social media, you know, saying that, you know, similar things to that, you know, the thing about, and I know you were sort of kind of using a cliche deliberately about turkeys voting for Christmas, but the fact is that the backbone of England, in particular, wants more of what we've had. That's what they want. I mean, it's not by default.
No, no.
It's not by, you know, manipulation.
Yeah, there's no tanks parked on any lawns.
No,
no,
exactly.
It was an election, and it was fought and won within the context that we all agreed we had a chance 5 years ago. Two years ago, wasn't it? I think, wasn't it, to change our voting system? Was it the AD referendum?
Yes, yeah.
And that was cast out. Well, I think actually it suffered from a lack of understanding and an apathy. It was run at a time when people just thought all politics could go hang, and people felt it was a deck chair rearrangement, were very scornful of that. But anyway, there it was. We had a chance to go for AV, and we rejected it. And so it was an election fought and won on a basis that everybody was agreed to. So I'm not screaming cheat at all. I'd be very, very interested to see whether the media can put together some sort of longer term exit polling, because I'm really very, very interested to know what drove the vote on the day. And I suspect what Miliband faced was what I call Kinnock syndrome, is that people didn't necessarily disagree with what he was saying and probably quite liked some of what he was saying. But when they came to the polling booth, they couldn't bring themselves to vote for him. They didn't see him as a prime minister, and if he failed in any sort of way, it was to cross that Rubicon of looking like a prime minister in waiting, and because he actually had quite a good campaign. There were none of these enormous gaffes that everybody was expecting, and I think he elevated himself considerably from his starting point. But on the day, I don't think people wanted him as a prime minister, and as Neil Kinnock found to his bitter cost, you can't turn people around from that at all, or at least very easily.
I think that's particularly nailed it, in that in a sense it's a question of trust, and I don't mean personal trust,
no,
but I mean trust with the welfare of the country, and in particular the economy. And I think that was perhaps the misunderstanding that many people took to during the campaign. They said, well, Mr. Miliband's had a good campaign and perhaps Mr. Cameron didn't, but once they've got the pencil in their hand,
yes,
and they're in the voting booth and they're thinking, well, who do I feel the most trust with in terms of being able to manage the country and manage the key elements, in particular the economy? I'm not saying whether people are right or wrong, but they think, do I trust Ed Balls? Clearly not. Or, you know, or do I trust the Conservatives? It appears they did. But I think we can come back to look at the events and what happens next in a minute. What I thought would be interesting to see the coverage, the coverage in the media, particularly overnight, and the coverage on TV, because as every time, the first few hours was something of a phony war with everyone simply speculating during the long wait for the flurry of results to emerge. The BBC, I felt, once again seemed to be, in quotes, the voice of the nation, but with a severe lack of women. I was really disappointed that the only sort of female figure on the screen sitting round the desks has been Laura Koonsberg. Yes. But they marginalised her to being plonked more or less out of shot and asked to monitor a laptop and give us Twitter updates.
Yeah, and she's very good as well.
Well, exactly.
When she did get a moment in the spotlight, she was very impressive. I thought the BBC tried to, in terms of special effects, tried to cover too many bases. I couldn't see the point of Jeremy Vine having his CGI Big Ben and then outside on the plaza having the Sophie Raworth with the big plug-in map thing. And, you know, there were just too many different ways of demonstrating the results as they came in. I think the BBC opened up the toy chest and got everything out. That was a bit distracting. I seem to think that they abandoned Jeremy Vine about
really
2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Where had he gone? Had he gone to bed, or had the equipment failed? Because he only appeared, what, half a dozen times, if that, which I found really strange, because that's one of the BBC's national treasures, isn't it? The swingometer, and that seems to get neglected.
Well, it is, but you see, I think in this sort of faster, speedier age, the results were coming in, and we had cameras everywhere, whereas in the past it was, well, we're just hearing that Labour have held Solihull. Now they have cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think Jeremy Vine and Sophie Raworth got marginalised, because there was always something happening from about 1 o'clock, 1:30 onwards, right through to about 5:30. There was always somewhere to go, somewhere to see the look on the face of Simon Hughes or whoever.
Yeah.
But I thought one element, though, and you mentioned it there, that we could have predicted would be a waste of time and space, was that huge map outside New Broadcasting House with poor Sophie Raworth and some members of the public who were, you could see, were shivering with the cold. And you know what, Magnus Short, this was one of those twerpish whiteboard blue sky thinking ideas. You know, you can imagine it being concocted in a breakout zone, you know, outside the Frankie Howard room.
Yes, you could.
And it was as hopeless, as you say, as one would have.
You might remember an episode of The Day Today where Alan Partridge has his World Cup signpost systems. You won't find this with FIFA, only with me. And of course it's completely incomprehensible and bits fall off it, and by the time he's positioned everything in the right place, it doesn't make any sense anymore. You know, it kind of reminded me of that, really, is that you know, they were plugging coloured hexagons, why they were hexagons, into a map. And poor old Sophie Raworth had to explain at the beginning that they'd made every constituency the same size as every other constituency, so what you saw was a immediately compromised as any kind of reference point, and then lots of probably unpaid interns had to spend the night in the cold shifting hexagons from one place to another.
Well, they got the public to do it. Sorry to, you know, contradict you,
no,
but they
was it? Okay,
she said, "Oh, we've got, you know, members of the 100 members of the public here help us."
Oh, I see. I thought they were just there to give vox pops, but anyway,
no, they were helping
the whole
take the
exercise,
hexagons in and out.
The whole exercise was pointless and fruitless and almost, like you say, spoof worthy. We could have been watching an episode of W1A or Brass Eye, really, couldn't we?
Elsewhere, I don't know if you switched over, on ITV,
it
was a slightly shabbier mirror of the BBC coverage.
Yeah.
But their opinion room intrigued me. It was a sort of railway train-style seating.
I actually tweeted asking if anybody knew why they were all in airline seats.
It's peculiar.
I expected somebody to come and check they've got their seatbelts done up and give them a tiny packet of peanuts and a minuscule can of Coke while they sat there.
So that was a bit odd. Sky, I felt, struggled. Sky News always has rather a tabloid air.
Yeah, more American, I think. Yeah, so.
Yes, it was. It was a bit Fox News-ish. Did you at all go to Sky Arts? Because
no, I didn't. It wasn't my automatic choice, I have to say.
No, but it was quite, in a way, it was quite absorbing, right. Because what Sky Arts were doing was showing behind-the-scenes views of the Sky News coverage.
Oh, that's so. Oh, right. I had no idea they were doing that. That's not a bad idea, really.
It was quite interesting. Mm. They it was a bit like a sort of high definition periscope.
Yeah.
In that they took their cameras into the control room of the Sky coverage and behind the presenters and so on. So it was like a kind of worm's eye view of the Sky coverage. And I have to say, somewhat alarmingly for Sky, that was far more interesting than the Sky News coverage.
Who was the anchor on Sky News?
I was going to say Kay Burley and Adam Bolton.
Oh, yes, naturally, yeah.
So, and you can imagine Kay Burley doing, you know, her normal routine to the camera, and Adam Bolton puffing away as much as you would have expected. But it was very much, I felt, trailing behind the BBC coverage, yeah. Which always seems to come good on these things.
Two things that struck me about the ITV coverage, because I stuck with the BBC like a good Englishman mostly throughout, but I did spend some time with ITV, and a couple of things struck me. One was that for about 2 hours they were displaying on their ticker that Labour had acquired 6 seats when there hadn't even been 6 declarations, and that stayed up on screen for perhaps 2 hours, I think, and Twitter filling up with people trying to point it out to them, but in their arrogance they ignored that. How that came to pass, I do not know. And the moment I flicked over, it was just in time to see a pundit say the word bastards, which I
thought, oh dear,
ITV have gone very edgy. He was actually quoting John Major and his reference to the Eurosceptics back in the day. But I missed all the preamble and just flicked over and a man said bastards. I thought
the BBC coverage, as I say, probably led the way. However, David Dimbleby was getting increasingly grouchy and grumpy through the night, because there were a number of times the director and the vision mixer let him down when, you know, that we were expecting to go somewhere and we went in the completely opposite direction, or that feed wasn't ready when he wanted. And I think he was getting more and more grumpy as the night.
We caught him in full grumpy, didn't we? Came out of a remote feed. Or maybe out of the national news, actually, and his fader went up a little bit prematurely to hear him saying, "For God's sake!"
For God's sake.
and behind him, a little runner.
Yes, crouching runner
with about 4 cups of coffee in her hands. So I think that the lid will remain on that forever. We can only speculate as to what we'd intruded into. But you're right, he wasn't a happy man at that point.
Yeah. So where do we go from here as a United Kingdom? The Scottish National Party, obviously, and quite rightly, are not going to lay back languidly on their benches at Westminster.
They are not.
It's a widely held view that Nicola Sturgeon had the best campaign of all the party leaders. I mean, she was admired south of the border. But you know, I was thinking, as the results came in Scotland, will members of the Women's Institute in Dorset and Methodists in Norfolk, B&B guest house owners in Great Yarmouth, remain as supportive when Nicola Sturgeon spells out her wishes for Scotland, including blocking the replacement of Triton, greater home rule, and a substantial increase in the NH budget north of the border?
Too late if guest house owners in Bournemouth suddenly feel less well disposed towards Nicola Sturgeon. It's too late. The democracy has laid its hand upon us, and she has enormous power, enormous influence in Scotland. What a result! Absolutely incredible. It broke the Mr. Vine's swingometer. There weren't enough numbers on the swing from Labour to SNP in some seats for him to display that to us. And as was pointed out over and over again, Michael Portillo was wiped off the political map with a swing of 17%, and that was earmarked as something unprecedented, we were looking at swings of 36% in Scotland from Labour to SNP, which even more extraordinary when you consider that the SNP failed in their primary mission, you know, what feels like a few months ago, to win a Scottish referendum. It was almost as if the Scots said no and then felt so bad, so guilty, that they delivered a no verdict on the referendum that they swung in behind the SNP. SNP now are, you could argue that they are, at least in the short term, the official or the unofficial opposition in the House of Commons now, because Labour are in disarray and SNP stand tall and proud.
And the opposition in Scotland now consists of one Conservative, one Liberal and one Labour MP.
That's right. Yeah.
That's your lot.
Yeah, that's your lot. That's your lot.
Back in England.
Two pandas.
Back in England, as we record this, Mr. Miliband and Mr. Clegg are both, we don't know for certain, but both surely certain, yes, to resign. Mm-hmm. For the Liberals, the choice is so limited that it has to be Tim Farron.
Yeah.
What about Labour? Yvette Cooper?
Yeah, probably. I think Yvette Cooper. The trouble is, decisions have to now be made very quickly for the Lib Dems and for Labour, and it's just the kind of decision that you don't want to make in a hurry. If there was any way of doing it, I'm sure both those parties would wait 6 months, wait a year, let the dust settle, and do this with a cool and calm head. But you can't do this. The fight back, as they always say, begins the next morning, and that includes choosing new leaders. But just, yes, on pure speculation, probably Yvette Cooper. She's a strong candidate. I think as her husband has now lost his seat and is at least for now out of politics, I think she can step into the limelight somewhat, because she can rebut any ludicrous notion that she's speaking for her husband. And acting as his stooge, not that she was ever likely to, but that accusation can't fly now. There's always the slightly embarrassing point for Labour is that they've never had a female leader, where the Conservatives have, which seems to be counterintuitive. But I'm not suggesting they would select her because she's a woman. She's obviously a capable person, but that.
She's so aligned now with the failed
Miliband
last
project.
Few years, Miliband project.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
That may count against
it. It may well, yes. And there's somebody whose name I literally have only heard this morning.
Dan Jarvis.
Since I got out of bed after 2 hours sleep, Dan Jarvis. Hotly tipped, and I'm a political anorak. I had never heard his name before. So maybe, you know, that is the new dawn that they so sorely need. I don't know.
Dan Jarvis, 42-year-old Barnsley MP, as you rightly say, widely unknown outside of immediate Labour circles. But there's his advantage. He's only been the MP for Barnsley Central because it was a by-election in March 2011. Now imagine if he becomes the leader, barely just over 4 years later. What an extraordinary thing. But of course, exactly the point that we were just saying, he's untainted by your lovely phrase, the Miliband project.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that would be obviously his pitch for the leadership, that he's a clean pair of hands, and that may well be what happened. Really, I think for Labour, it's not that essential as to who they pick for the Labour leader, but what direction that person now takes the party. Do they push far left, not far, far left, but do they push to the left and stand up as...
They'd be mad if they did, but I take your point.
Well, but the option is there to regain their colours as a socialist party, or do they push back into the centre ground, which has a whiff of Blair and to a certain extent Ed about it. It's hard to know which way would be worthwhile for them to go. I think what they will end up doing is picking their way carefully through a probably heavily mined wheat field, because this was not in the script, and they must be absolutely reeling. I would not fancy being a decision maker in Millbank at the moment. It's a very tough.
Indeed. Where do we stand now in terms of our membership of the European Union? And the country is not waking up to the sight of Mr. Farage waving from the steps of number 10.
Yeah, there's a firecracker that fizzled, yes.
Oh, very much. Again, this business, isn't it? Again, this thing about percent. You can come second in every seat in the country and lose by one vote, but you have no MPs. So you can have a massive, you can show a percentage of 16-20% in the opinion polls, but it's not going to translate into seats.
I had to feel a bit sorry for the Green Party and Natalie Bennett, who tweeted, fantastic news, we've come second, she said, in one declaration. I thought, well, you've either got to be the world's greatest optimist or a little bit desperate to be, dancing around the Maypole over coming second.
No, poor old Natalie. But, in terms of UKIP, what they will be saying, of course, is that they've made such huge inroads in terms of coming a decent second in some places and a decent third in others where it may not have been expected, that it'll be a springboard for 2020. And there may be some credibility to that, although, a week is a long time in politics. Yeah. 5 years is a millennium. But has Mr. Farage and his UKIPers, do you think they've made a big enough splash to ensure that we do think again about Europe?
What they've managed to do is keep Europe on the agenda and to make people a bit scared of Europe. I don't like any politics which depends on frightening people for its bread and butter, but that's exactly what UKIP have done. I mean, in many ways, they are the party of scaring people. If they have succeeded in any way, it is to convince people that Europe is a massive thorn in our side. Of course it isn't, it's much more nuanced than that, we benefit as much as we are put at a disadvantage by Europe, I guess. I would say that we benefit much more than we are put at a disadvantage, but that is not to say there isn't anything wrong with the European Union. There's an awful lot wrong with the European Union, but you don't put anything right by leaving it to rot on the pavement and walking away from it. I think UKIP, this was their shot. I think for UKIP, this was their shot. I think in future by-elections or the next general election 5 years' time, if they are still singing from that EU bashing hymn sheet, then people will be thoroughly fed up with it. And by then, if Mr. Cameron is as good as his word, we will have had a referendum anyway.
I think what the main parties have not grasped is the issue for people in the home counties. And I refer to a particular moment that a lot of media and Twitterati made fun of was in the early part of the election campaign. Nigel Farage, was quoted as saying that the reason that he was late for a party meeting in Wales was because of the traffic on the M4, and of course it was because of... Now, it's natural to laugh about that, and I understand why people do, particularly people like your good self, who don't live in the South East. However, regardless, I know, everybody knows me, this is nothing to do with race, colour, creed, it's about numbers, it's just about numbers. In the South East, people living in the South East, you can't help but notice the overcrowding everywhere you go, on the roads, on public transport, on the streets, particularly in London. As I say, it's nothing to do with where you come from or whether you've been. It doesn't matter whether you've been in the country 10 minutes or your family goes back to William the Conqueror. It's just about numbers. And those EU rules make it almost impossible to draw a line that all, it seems, parties seek to say, look, we can't cope in terms, as I say, it's got nothing to do with where you come from. It's to do with doctors, waiting rooms being full. dentists. You can't get an appointment at your doctor's in the southeast.
Every and any policy needs to be an intelligent policy, and the political classes of all persuasions have singularly failed to concoct and even offer the populace an intelligent, well thought out strategic view on border controls and immigration. To say everyone can come in is as stupid as saying nobody can come in. That is not intelligent, well thought out policy. But it's such a political hot potato that all the background men drag their clients away from that issue every time it is raised, unless of course we're talking about UKIP, and therefore no policy of any worth, of any productivity, gets established. So it's such a badly mishandled part of British life that it's not surprising that we've got a situation that nobody is happy with. I will bow to your sociological insights. That is why the roads are clogged up in your part of the world.
Well, exactly, and that's what, I know this is like, look at what the man in the street says to me, but people constantly say to me, that live in the home counties, the southeast of England, 10 years ago, my commute to work, 3 miles, used to take me 10 minutes. Now it takes me 45 minutes. And, we shouldn't dismiss that as you're saying, walk then or something. It's actually inconvenience people to the point of, when people take their children to school, they're having to allow a ridiculous amount of time to actually get there because of the sheer volume of people.
Half decent public transport infrastructure.
Well, we don't have it. But we don't have it.
What I'm saying. That half decent, affordable and accessible and reliable public transport infrastructure might also be part of the picture, then. But we don't have anything resembling that.
I needed to make a doctor's appointment in the early part of December, 3 or 4 months ago, and it took me a 100 calls. you have to phone on the day. It's the only way. You can't make an appointment in advance. You have to phone in the day, and then it's a kind of lottery. Now, I live in Berkshire. 100 phone calls to get through, to the doctor's receptionist. And that's the kind of thing that, it hits home to people in their day-to-day lives. If it had been, it fortunately wasn't an emergency, but if it had been, it would have made me think, I need to reflect this in my vote. Anyway, I think we let's move away from the general election for at least a few minutes.
All I would add is that I did find it hard to concentrate at times watching the BBC's coverage. I was distracted hugely by what is happening on Andrew Neil's head.
Yes.
Is it being held on by paper clips, I think, now, isn't it?
It is an extraordinary confection. It really must be said.
I think
really
he's inherited Robert Robinson's mantle of unusual hair arrangement on television, hasn't he?
He really is trying to hold back the years, but without a great deal of success. These days, any police investigation with the word operation in front of it automatically sends a shiver down our spines. In particular, Operation Yew Tree, of course, has uncovered a nightmarish series of crimes, most of them historical and most of them leaving us hollow with frustration. But more wasn't done at the time. Now, receiving less publicity is Operation Elvedon, a police investigation into allegations of payments by journalists to police in order to gain confidential information. It's not so easy to keep track, but by my figures, 62 people have been arrested in Operation Elvedon. 16 cases have gone to trial, and of that 16, 14 journalists were cleared by the jury at the time. And of the other two, one guilty verdict quashed by the Court of Appeal, and the other has been given leave to appeal. Estimates of the cost of Operation Elvedon to date vary from £11 million to £20 million. Alison Saunders is the Director of Public Prosecutions. She's got some serious questions to answer on Operation Elvedon.
Certainly has. And I guess, in a way, the Crown Prosecution Service are damned if they do and damned if they don't on issues like this. If they had not moved against the people who were stood accused of corruption in high places, then they would have been accused of a whitewash, of an establishment stitch-up. But having moved against them and failed, now they are accused of wasting public money and persecuting innocent people. It's a tough call. However, one would like to think they were independent and strong enough to have said, no, the cases aren't strong enough, and taken the flak, whatever. They're big enough and ugly enough to take whatever public flak comes their way. And we would not be 11 million or between 11 and 20 million pounds the lighter for the escapade. But I do acknowledge that there is a tough judgment call to make there, and it's not one I would care to make.
Some journalists have told of police turning up at their homes before dawn and bundling them into police vans whilst their children literally were screaming and crying, yes, indoors. And one journalist in particular is described as, I quote, 2 years of torture before being found not guilty. I think the DPP has failed to grasp the concept of public interest, because it's still not possible to speak of specific cases, but broadly we can say there is a world of difference in terms of public interest between, say, a journalist paying a copper for some gossip about some pop star caught in difficult circumstances with his trousers around his ankles, yeah, and that same journalist paying a police informant for information that might show corruption, mm-hmm, amongst politicians or people being paid from the public purse.
There is there's an enormous difference, of course, and I think the establishment is as susceptible to furores as anybody else. And when it started to become apparent that the fourth estate, the press, particularly the printed press, were in some sort of state of disarray and were engaged in nefarious practices on a regular basis, there was a lot of ground to be made up, and there was a lot of, if you'll pardon the French, a lot of arses to be covered. And I think, you know, a firestorm can result where all sorts of people get dragged into it. And I know it's not Elverdon, it's Yew Tree, but you think of various people who were caught up in the Yew Tree operation, who were found entirely innocent, whose lives must have been unbearable for a long period of time. And you know, that was the same thing. That was the reaction to not having nailed Jimmy Savile. So it was almost compensatory. And I think that's what's happened with Elverdon, is that that there's been an attempt to backpedal furiously and try and catch what should have been caught previously. And, this kind of operation done with a view to a rearguard action can't possibly be done sensibly and with a cool head, and I guess that's what's happened.
Yeah, it's arguable that the DPP has done immense damage by pursuing the wrong people for simply doing their job, in that real corruption might be harder to prosecute because of this this debacle.
It is a debacle, yes, but I think it's not a mystery as to how these things come about. And I think when people fear that they're going to be shown to be impotent, then an overreaction is all too frequent. I think that's what's been happening here. I also wonder who has walked away with a smug grin on their face that they were really up to something that was outside of the public interest, and it never touched them because they weren't the low hanging fruit.
Now, Magnus Shaw, what's up, UK? What's up, UK?
Don't do that again.
No,
never do that again.
It's really awful, isn't it? That's the cry from Periscope broadcasters in America when anyone from the United Kingdom joins their feed.
They understand us.
They really do. They see someone, someone says, "Hi, I'm from Luton in England," and to a man and a woman, they go, "Hey, sup, UK?" That's the even worse thing. Instead of saying "What's up, UK?"
Sup.
They sup. Sup UK. Yes.
Well, they don't realise to us that is an old English word to have a little drink and a bite to eat. But I don't think they mean that, do they?
I don't think so. No, I think they mean it's trying to be hip. and as if you're coming out of Compton, even though you're living in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
It's a way of saying hello, but you have to say, hey, what's up?
But Americans don't have that same level of self-embarrassment that we have, you see.
Not at all.
To holler, what's up, UK? It would not, no American would go to bed at night thinking, oh, my goodness, I didn't really say that, did I? Of course, the average Englishman tortures himself every night about the things he said the previous day.
I fully realised it made me sound a complete idiot when I said, what's up, you guys?
Yeah, but if you were American, you wouldn't care, you see.
Oh, not at all. Yeah. But that's the cry on Periscope. And Periscope just grows and grows, and it hit its first major controversy last weekend. Now, over its short month in existence, I've already watched Mary J. Blige, Barry Manilow, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds live in concert via someone broadcasting from a venue where they've been appearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also watched live baseball and football, all with surprisingly decent quality. But last Saturday night, Floyd Mayweather fought Manny Pacquiao to unify the world welterweight title. Viewers in America could stump up $90 for the pay-per-view fight. In the UK, Sky wanted £20.
Mm-hmm.
Or there was the prospect of unofficial feeds on the internet, which HBO and Showtime took great trouble to try and close. Or, even further, you could have watched it on a choice of a vast number of Periscope feeds from people rebroadcasting the fight by focusing the camera on their iPhone, on their television screens,
yes,
in their homes. And again, it was very watchable quality. This is the new piracy. Can the man do anything to stop this new wave of broadcasting?
No, I mean, as has been shown before with Napster and Pirate Bay, it's you can't put the genie back in the bottle, and there will be much to-ing and fro-ing between Periscope and various copyright holders, not just HBO or big broadcasters, but people like Noel Gallagher's management and whoever else. What you have essentially done with Periscope is give everybody a television station, which they can operate without regulation or fee. And I can't see how this can be stemmed in any meaningful way. Presumably, you can join Periscope in the same way as you can join Twitter with minimal revelation of your identity, and
it's just you use your Twitter identity.
Well, there you go, exactly so. And bingo, you have your own TV station. Now, that isn't a problem if you're filming Harry the Jack Russell chasing his ball in the park. It's slightly more contentious if you're filming a pay-per-view boxing match and redistributing it across the internet. But unfortunately, what you have is the giant edifices of old media. The pay-per-view channels, the satellite channels, rock concert promoters, record companies, versus the incredibly nimble and fast-moving and ever-changing arena of new media, which puts the power which made these enormous establishments so wealthy into the hands of people who aren't seeking wealth from it, but are actually managing to undermine and subvert these giant corporations. I don't know how you can stop it. Either we have this new media, the lid is off, and it's a free-for-all for people to play with, experiment with, and use for their own purposes, or we don't. And I think, you know, we're in a state of flux where the old media is giving out to the new media, and nobody knows quite what to do.
It's quite peculiar, because you'd think that Twitter, who own Periscope, may be edgy about this situation, but Twitter's CEO, Dick Costolo, actually tweeted with some sort of triumph that Periscope was the real winner of the night. Periscope did shut down a large number of streams of the fight, but the sheer number of people rebroadcasting it meant they couldn't keep up. I certainly had no problem finding a wide range of options. You know, you just had to go on to the, you know, the global suggestions for Periscope, and there were a dozen every time.
Well,
one
that's
closed
my
down another.
That's my whole point. I mean, it is like an elephant trying to catch a gazelle, isn't it? It is.
It reminds me, though, Magnus, of our discussion about how we felt the music streaming service Tidal would fail because users don't care about the enhanced quality over Spotify. Mm-hmm. In the same way, if you want to watch a sporting contest or see a band live but don't have that commitment to fork out $90, then someone streaming it by holding their iPhone camera up to a TV screen is perfectly acceptable.
Yes, well, that's absolutely right. I think, of course, as soon as you say to somebody, well, this very expensive thing is free, but it's not quite as good as the expensive version, people will take that trade-off. People don't really mind that compromise. I think if you knocked on somebody's door and said, look, I know you're thinking of buying a new car, and I know you're thinking of investing, you know, £20,000 in some state-of-the-art Range Rover. However, I have this nice little runaround here, works perfectly well. It's not your Range Rover, but you know, it's a little Honda Civic. The point being, you can have it for free. Well, I think you'd find a lot of takers, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would. There are a number of possibilities for the man to get worked up about. Test matches, cricket test matches, Premiership football matches, currently all behind a Sky or BT subscription. And, you know, we may even see the headliners at Glastonbury this summer on Periscope. You know, maybe Prince William will Periscope the christening of Princess Charlotte. You know, possibilities are somewhat endless.
Well, Robbie Williams broadcast just a little ahead of Periscope the birth of his child, didn't he?
He did, yes.
So we'll see a lot of that, I am sure. And of course it will be used for PR purposes. And the very same people who are bemoaning the fact that somebody went to their show, whether it's a boxing match or you know, a gig of some sort, and without permission broadcast it to all and sundry, are exactly the same people who will seize on it for promoting those self same shows, boxing matches, albums, or whatever. So they'll dirty their own hands as long as they have the control. It's when they don't have the control that they start to get antsy, you know.
Exactly. So now, Magnus Shaw, slow down. You move too fast. it's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. And we zoom around it and within it. And we all wonder, you know, where the days go. The slow movement, and in particular slow television, seeks to give us some moments of calm in a frenetic world. SACTA TV is what it's called in Norway, in Norwegian, SACTA TV. Okay. That means slow TV.
I was going to say, do we know what SACTA means? Okay.
Yeah, slow TV.
Every day is a school day, yes.
There we are. They lead the way in slow television in Norway. Long train journeys, they've shown a ship crossing from Bergen to Kirkenes, 8 hours looking at a fire, all without interruption, commercials or narration. You simply look at something happening in real time. BBC Four are running a slow TV season here in the UK, and on Tuesday we followed a canal boat through the British countryside for 2 hours in real time, with no narrator, no commercials, and just the natural sounds that occurred during the journey. Did you manage to slow down for 2 hours?
Not for 2 hours, no. I suppose, ironically, I didn't have the full 2 hours to spare because I had things to do, which I suppose is rather against the spirit of the thing. But I did watch it for longer than I expected to. Because like all the boorish hordes who probably felt the same thing I felt, what's in it for me to watch, you know, a steady cam on the prow of a a barge going around the canals of England. How could that possibly capture my attention? But you know what? It was incredibly hypnotic, isn't it? I did think the technical crew deserved all the plaudits here, because somehow the footage was really crisp, wasn't it? I wasn't watching in HD or anything, but it was just really crisp, and there was real depth to the shot. I don't know what kind of equipment they were using, but every moment looked like a picture postcard. The sky looked terrific, and the buildings looked grainy and textured, and I think that's where it won out, because the technical quality was so high that it captured your eyesight and your senses so well. How they managed to and plaudits here again for the sound crew, how they managed to mask the engine sound of the barge, because those things can be quite chuggy, you know. You see them go past when you're on a country walk, or indeed down Paddington Way with the barges going past there. They can be quite noisy, but you could just about hear the purr of the engine. So there was some very strategic miking going on. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I think I had it for about 40 minutes. Yes, I don't know if it's because I've watched too many horror movies or thrillers in the dark nights of my soul, but I did at one point feel quite apprehensive, because we don't see extended periods of calm and silence usually, unless it's preceding some dreadful event. So I thought the barge may at some point come round the corner to be met by a slathering T-Rex or a plague of zombies, just out of sight and just out of earshot with the soaring violins of a terrible denouement to a horror movie, and we were about to rip to pieces by a supernatural being. I'm glad to say that didn't happen, and I could relax again. But it did have that sort of silent air of menace. But that is just purely because we're not used to that sedate pace in a broadcast program or any kind of film at all. So it kind of betrays our prejudice towards what we expect to see on our screens. I think this is a really great idea. It's a shame that it's not an original idea. I didn't realise it had been purloined from another country, but it's original to us, and I think it's quite brave to put it on, and I think it works, and I think if they stick with it, I can see an audience gathering around it to use the television for something slightly different.
Oh, I could watch this sort of thing every day, and I really do mean I really could every day. I've talked before about my addiction to watching QVC and Ideal World TV, the shopping channels. Even though I've never bought anything in my life, but I find it hypnotic in the same way as that
I'm
journey
like that
down.
With snooker. I don't like.
Yes,
I don't like snooker. I don't understand the subtleties of it. I know how it's played, but I don't understand, you know, safety shots and things like that. Yes, I don't really want to. But if I've got half an hour before I intend to go to bed and I happen upon snooker, sometimes, just sometimes, I will sit sipping a cup of tea and just gazing at snooker.
That's what I do with QVC. Yeah. I just, you know, it's almost like let it wash over me. But this show was delicious on widescreen high definition TV, you know, the reasons you indicated, the sheer beauty of the surroundings. But what a joy. No music, no narrator, and best of all, Magnus Shaw, nobody having a go. No John Craven or Matt Baker hoving into view and saying, and then I had a go at driving the barge myself. You know, none of that malarkey at all, which was
good. I was kind of thought maybe right at the very end there'd be a panel of minor celebrities judging the barge on its performance, yes, you know, with buzzers that they could press to say a good barge, bad barge buzzers.
Oh, Lord. One of the elements I really liked, you know, you talked about some of the technical work that went into it. How beautiful it was that they put captions laid into the landscape so that you didn't get a block like you do in those dreadful, you know, top of the pop 2 type things where you get great big blocks of screen across it saying, you know, some information. They beautifully laid the information into the water or on a bridge.
I don't think it needed that. I thought that was a slight compromise that I just sensed that the producer might be thinking, can we really just go with the barge? I thought that sort of took the gloss off it a little bit. So, I can't resist putting some graphics in here, which seemed to corrupt the thing a little bit. But I could have done without
it. It did bring us back to reality a little, didn't it?
Yeah. I just thought it showed a loss of nerve, really, a little bit. And it wouldn't have suffered for not having it. And it may have sort of maintained the purity of it a little bit. But there you go. It was a very interesting piece of television at a point where we tend to feel that TV has done all it possibly can. Here's something that we've not seen before.
Well, one sort of trivial point that occurred to me, because I watched the whole 2 hours, is it seems a lot of people live on boats, because there were so many moored to the towpaths that seemed to be, as they call it in boat parlance, liverboards. Liverboard boats. An enormous number of people living on boats. But I do admire the whole concept of the slow movement. We actually discussed this about 3 or 4 years ago on our podcast. But I remember particularly that we talked about the idea of slow food, where we try and take our time instead of, you know, bolting down a Burger King or Big Mac on the run.
Yeah, that's right,
I absolutely genuinely have taken this on board. I certainly drive slower these days. I consciously head for the inside lane and leave the whooshing and rushing to others. Mm-hmm. And also, I think from following sort of Buddhist principles, I often try and walk slower, you know, living in the moment and taking my time. So I say slow is good.
And your staff, do you encourage them to serve you a bit slower?
Oh, no, they have to double up in time to compensate for my slowness.
Yeah.
This was all aboard the canal trip. It was shown on Tuesday, the 5th of May, on BBC Four at 8 p.m. It is on the iPlayer for a month, so if you fancy a couple of hours of slowing down, it's right there for you. Joyfully, there was no narrator, and it was produced by Luke Corson Martin.
Which means, sadly, it's time to close the parish council polling station for this week, perhaps for 5 years. We're off for a plate of tatties and neeps round at Nicola Sturgeon's place. It seems to be doing her the power of good, and why shouldn't we benefit from it too? It's just time to say thanks to the steadfast Terence Dackham.
Sup!
You are, sir. You are up. And, of course, to you, our favourite listener, thanks very much for joining us. Until next time, then, I'm Magnus Shaw. Bye-bye.
You make me want to sing about love every time I raise my head. You make me want to tell the whole world what I found is good. Then they say slow. Don't let
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.